This is SG2 Perspectives, a conversation with industry experts and SG2 thought leaders about the biggest trends in healthcare and what we all expect that's going to mean for the future of healthcare delivery.
Employers have very little transparency to the cost that they pay for healthcare coverage for their employees and families, and even less into the drivers of what can change that cost. I was told by a large employer, and I'll never forget this experience, that they understood more about the cost of their toilet paper usage than they did about the cost of their healthcare. That was not a ringing endorsement for our industry.
Hello, and welcome to SG2 Perspectives. I am your host, Kelly Richard, and today we will be continuing our conversation on value-based care strategy with James Harker, Chief Population Health Officer at Providence St. Joseph Health System in Oregon. Please enjoy part two of our two-part series. We've done some research in the past. We'll talk about the concept of whether it makes sense to interpret the tipping point as the percent of total revenue, or is it better to think about it as the percent of your patient population that you're taking care of under a value-based care arrangement. But it sort of quickly becomes this conversation of where the devil is in the details. So what does risk mean? And you kind of mentioned too that you are counting some of those categories of shared savings and shared risk versus just thinking purely on capitation. What is your perspective on the tipping point? Does the tipping point matter?
Yeah, it absolutely matters. And I think measuring it is the first step. And I appreciate you calling out maybe the two most kind of common approaches to that. And we measure both. So I measure my value-based care contracts and revenue as a percentage of my total revenue across the continuum, both from primary through acute services. And we are right at 50%. As measured as a percent of revenue. And again, remember, we have our own health plan. That makes a big difference. We also measure the number of lives in these contracts. I don't love the term lives. Lives are people.
Sure.
The number of members, the number of people in these contracts. And we use as then as a denominator, we compare that to the number of people that we serve in total. And that can be a difficult thing to get, that number in healthcare, because I would argue, for so long, we have been dependent on a model, a fee-for-service model that was all about widgets of care produced, the number of things that we do to people, rather than the number of people that we serve. And I would suggest that most health systems in the country cannot tell you the actual unique number of people that they serve. They can tell you the number of services they've provided. You have to eliminate duplication across all your different lines of business. I apologize for going down this tangent a little bit, but myself, at Providence, I'm insured by our health plan, so I count once in their database. My physician is one of our employed physicians, so I count in that database. And I've had maybe some kind of lab work or something in one of our hospitals, so I count in that database. To truly understand the number of unique people that you serve, you have to eliminate the instances of James Harker twice and only count me once. So once you understand that count, then I can tell you, all right, how many of the people that I serve are actually represented by these value-based or preferable sort of contracts or financial agreements. And that number is just under 50. It's in the mid-40% for us. And we're trying to drive that number higher. The tipping point, why it's critical, I think, and again, this is where some clinicians who are engaged in this kind of work would be important to weigh in on this question, but it's the incentives that it creates for changing practice. Our medical group needs to know that they're going to reach a point at some place where for their entire panel, for all the patients they serve, that they can start seeing them via virtual care or investing in preventative services, and that they can step off of that RVU treadmill for everyone that they serve. And they can ignore the fact that this person is a national PPO, has national PPO insurance, and this person has Providence Health Plan insurance. There's no reason that a clinician, a physician practicing day to day should have to worry about that. We got to get them over that tipping point so that financially it matters less.
And I think you've mentioned this a couple of times, but Providence owns a health plan. Yeah. And how much of a factor do you think that's been in getting over that organizational buy-in to pursue value so aggressively?
I've already mentioned it a couple of times, which would suggest it is pretty important. We have about 600,000 lives in our health plan, which is a big number in a state the size of Oregon. Traditionally, and even today, an insurance company or a health plan, which is a funny term, frankly, health plan.
We could do another episode just on some of these terms, I think.
And where they come from. What does that really mean? I get the term insurance. They're providing insurance.
Right.
They have traditionally and still have the most direct relationship with our ultimate customer, with the member. They often have the first point of relationship. And because of that, I would say our health plan has long been a strong voice for affordability and excellence in conversations around our leadership tables. 10 years ago, when these were sort of fledgling conversations, they were the ones arguing for affordability. They were the ones looking at the cost curve and saying, you know, if you look at total cost for a population, what? What do you mean if you look at total? What does that mean? They brought that perspective. They were very committed to an integrated model in working closely with Providence, the delivery side. But they brought, perhaps in the earlier days, a different voice. They also brought a much more comprehensive data set when it comes to cost, because they pay all the claims, regardless of where that healthcare or that service is provided. They have that data and they can track that data. And it's an important and a helpful lens when we try to talk about accountability or clinical appropriateness. When I've thought about this, when I've had this conversation with my counterparts in other parts of Providence St. Joseph Health, I do think a strong ACO, I don't think owning a health plan is a deal breaker. I know of examples of health systems that have very strong ACOs, accountable care organizations, that include a clinically integrated network of physicians, both employed and non, doesn't matter, as long as they're tightly clinically integrated. I think they can drive as much change toward these value-based models, working with independent health plans in their market, as we have with our own health plan. It's fair to say that providers, ourselves included, have long used our strength, our market strength, either because of our size or perhaps for a medical group because they're the only ones with a particular specialty in a metropolitan area. They've used that to their advantage in the business model that was in place at the time. And if it was about fee-for-service, they've used it for conversion factors for their RVUs. That's just the truth. That's how a negotiation has worked. I think those groups can use the same strength to negotiate for alternative payment models and say, you know what? In the future, the only way we're going to work is where we have accountability for and direct access to the portion of the premium dollar that's related to our services. We'll own that accountability, but we're also going to share both the upside and the downside risk if we manage that budget well. That's a conversation that groups can have, that are having. Clinically integrated networks in this country are having that conversation because they know how to practice that way and they're being very successful. So you don't have to have your own plan.
Right. It's almost like the things that you had due to having a plan were the risk and therefore the incentive to talk about affordability, the data, and the network. And if you can get that another way, then maybe you don't have to actually be processing claims.
Exactly. That's much more concisely said.
So while we're talking about payers, let's talk payer segment here. We often hear about value-based care as an opportunity with Medicare and Medicaid, more on the government payer side, but employers represent some very under-leveraged market power here. Do you see employers as a target for the shift to value?
Definitely, yes. Have to underscore that. Not only are they a target, but they're the key. Let's not forget that payer mix still matters in a value-based population health world. Our model, the business model may change, payer mix still matters. These alternative payment models, they certainly create better incentives, but that does not change the fact that government programs do not pay enough to cover our current operating costs. We are on a journey, healthcare in general and across the country is on a journey towards greater affordability. And we talk about being able to operate at Medicare. And that's an important and a valuable and a great goal. But that's a journey. In the meantime, payer mix matters and commercial mix with those employers matter. My experience has been I work pretty closely with my health plan partners here in Oregon with different employers. Employers have very little transparency to the cost that they pay for healthcare coverage for their employees and families, and even less into the drivers of what can change that cost. I was told by a large employer, and I'll never forget this experience, that they understood more about the cost of their toilet paper usage than they did about the cost of their healthcare. That was not a ringing endorsement for our industry.
No.
Right? Told me that to my face. The largest healthcare provider in the state, and a certainly an important producer of a product that they use, they were not happy with my product. We've turned that around. I mean, that was a clarion call to us for accountability and transparency, and they wanted to work directly with us. If you offer an employer transparency and accountability for the product that you produce, transparency of cost and accountability for the work that you do for them, you will win their business and you will have a balanced payer mix.
And one of the common arguments we sometimes hear about employers shifting to value is that employees are going to demand choice in a narrow network that you get with a value-based arrangement. That's not going to be an option. Do you think that that's a valid argument?
To a degree. I mean, you're going to hear that with any employer, large or small, because they may have a very vocal person on their team or a group of people that use a particular provider. I suggest we've had experience that you just need to let employees share some of the same accountability that we talk about with the employer. And it's a three-legged stool, if you will. We bear accountability, the employer bears some accountability, and that employee does as well. Choice that you're talking about comes with a cost. If that employee wants broader access, we believe there should be a differential cost for that. We have been successful doing that. They still have the access that they want. It may be, again, differentially a little more expensive, but that's, to me, about sharing the accountability.
Yeah, and maybe it's my generation, I don't know, but I have never once made a decision about whether I was going to take a job based on the healthcare insurance that was offered. It seems like there's always two or three choices, and they're probably good enough. However, maybe that's coming from a young, fairly healthy person.
Well, I might suggest, and I don't know you well enough to say, but you probably have worked for somewhat larger employers most of your career also.
Half and half, probably.
Okay. We have that experience with smaller employers in this state, and that can be a concern, especially with somebody who already has an established care relationship. And if it's them or a family member for a condition that's pretty critical, pretty important, you don't want to go changing providers sort of midstream in your clinical experience. So it can matter. And we do get that question from employers.
And come to think of it, it could be also the increase in chronically ill patients that we're starting to see. All of that may matter more and more. What about Medicare Advantage? Do you see that as a significant value accelerator?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a fan of CMS in general as a value accelerator. Medicare Advantage, in particular MA, was an early version of alternative payment models. It's helped a lot of medical groups, health systems, including ours, understand and learn how to practice within a capitated model. And many do very well once they understand that budget and the members or the patients that they're caring for. CMS continues to advocate for alternative payment, for shared accountability, for risk, if you will, including in their traditional population. There is incentives built in inherently for their members to select MA products. I think CMS is asking us as healthcare to do the right things.
Right. I always have to wonder too that if at some point for Medicare Advantage specifically, will CMS start to push those rates down a little bit more because currently payers are just making so much money on them?
I think it's inevitable, right? I think that's CMS's approach. They have to start either neutral or neutral plus in terms of the total dollars that are flowing into the health system. And then once they find a model that works and can actually drive more affordability, lower total cost for their population, I think then they can constrain a little bit the dollars, the premium that's going in. And that will affect incomes. That goes back to my point, though, about operating at Medicare. We've got to figure out, we can't just keep taking this additional premium that CMS is paying for MA. We've got to figure out a way to operate at traditional fee-for-service Medicare reimbursement. That's a good bellwether. We should be looking at that in terms of whether or not we can sustain our operations there.
I have to think that that Medicare Advantage party is going to be over at some point, but
absolutely.
You had mentioned a little bit earlier community health and caring for some of those more vulnerable populations. That makes me think a little bit about Medicaid. And have you been able to make any progress in the shift to value at the state level? And have you been able to pull in any of those community health improvement initiatives into those value-based contracts?
So here again is where my maybe limited strategic planning chops kind of sync up or mesh well with the benefit of being in Oregon and being with Providence. Many of you will know that Oregon was blessed with a transition in its Medicaid program several years ago toward coordinated care organizations, CCOs, the idea that you have an organization that sort of owns the total budget for the membership, the Oregon Health Plan or the Medicaid membership in that region, that part of the state, and engages with the care delivery enterprise, independents, large health systems, everyone, to bring them together in service to those members. Along with that came the dollars, obviously the premium dollars for those members, distributed to RAEs, risk-accepting entities, of which Providence Health Plan is one. So basically how it works is membership is assigned to these different risk-accepting entities, like Providence Health Plan, and the dollars flow on a capitated basis, basically, for those members. So we've been fortunate enough to be able to manage and work with, if you will, that population in a value-based way now for several years. And again, to your point, that's exactly what it incentivizes. It encourages you to look at community health initiatives. It encourages you to look at community partners who, frankly, are doing a more efficient job of caring for the same population at a lower price point. They're reaching out. They're often providing a lot of the social drivers of health that we as the healthcare industry don't understand as well. And when the dollars flow like that, you have more incentive to look for those kind of models.
One last question. What do you think is most important for actually executing on value-based care strategy?
That's always a high standard, right? I have to kind of go back to my roots as an old strategy guy and say it's about shared vision and engagement. I truly believe that you need the engagement of the entire leadership team in a health system, in a medical group, whichever entity it may be. They need to collectively have a shared understanding of and support the value drivers that can move your organization toward these kind of models. You're going to need all of their support. You're going to need the ongoing support and commitment. Change models often talk about a shared vision, shared understanding. And I think that's where you have to start. I certainly couldn't do this if our chief executive, if the person runs the hospitals, if they didn't believe in this shift toward value-based models, if they didn't understand how they were going to have to work differently when they had a sort of a budget or accountability for a set amount of the healthcare spend and have a desire to understand how the accounting works differently, a willingness to embrace community health providers that may work with us in a different way. And the list goes on and on. Without that support, it would be very difficult to move forward with as significant a shift as I believe value-based care is going to represent for our industry.
Great. And I'm wondering, too, if COVID-19 will help other organizations get there that have sort of had that as a barrier in the past.
Well, like we said, it certainly is going to shine a light on the value of being there, that it's a more sustainable model. It lines up with how clinicians want to practice, and it's more sustainable in a very tumultuous time like COVID has thrown us into.
Great. Value-based care, though.
What about it? It's value-based care, though.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining me for this series on value-based care strategy with James Harker from Providence St. Joseph's in Oregon. If you like what you're hearing, please also listen and subscribe to our colleague Dr. Tom Villanueva's Modern Practice podcast on Vizient's Medical Leadership Channel. Tom discusses key healthcare trends through the clinical leadership lens. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening and stay healthy.
This has been another great episode of SG2 Perspectives, where industry experts and SG2 thought leaders explore the drivers of tomorrow's healthcare strategies to inform today's decision makers. Contact us anytime by sending an email to sg2perspectives@sg2.com. We'd love to hear from you. SG2 revolutionized healthcare demand forecasting with the Impact of Change forecast, and today we're the industry's premier strategy advisory firm. To learn more, visit sg2.com. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you again soon.